طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we have a unique Palestinian voice, an engineer environmentalist engaged in exciting work developing sustainable energy and water resources where they are most needed, in isolated communities in the West Bank. Stephen Lowe interviews Mohammed El Haraz, who tells the story of his education and work at the Arava Institute for Environmental Studies, an introduction to the world of sustainable energy through his work with compatible Israeli innovators at an organization called CometMe. CometMe is an Israeli Palestinian nonprofit organization providing sustainable energy and clean water resources to the off-grid communities. They facilitate social and economic empowerment of some of the most marginalized communities in the West Bank through the construction of wind and solar systems, water solutions, capacity building, and maintenance.
Okay, I'm Steve Lowe, and I'm sitting here with Mohammed El Haraz, who's visiting the Boston area from Palestine. I first met Mohammed in 2014 when I visited the South Hebron Hills and encountered him at a project that I found very interesting called CometMe. And Mohammed is now in the States, not for the first time. And I thought it would be interesting to the listeners of This Week in Palestine to hear a little bit about why he's here and about his background. So, welcome to Boston.
All right, thank you.
You're very welcome. So I guess the first question I really should ask you is, what brought you to the United States?
So what I'm doing right now is I'm here for about a 20-day trip. I'm doing a speaking tour for the Arava Institute of for the Environmental Studies. So it's a program that is it's an academic program that is affiliated with Ben Gurion University of the Negev, and it brings people from almost everywhere. So it brings people from Palestine, from Jordan, from Israel, and all over the world. So we have like 1/3 of students to be like Palestinians, Jordanians, and 1/3 Israelis, and 1/3, you know, people from like international students to come and join the program. So the program offers different courses, 4 to 5 courses per semester, and you can have like 2 semesters and as a student, and you can also work there as an intern. And what is interesting about the institute is that it has 4 different research centers. You have sustainable ecology, agriculture, and a center that focuses on transboundary water management, and also energy, sustainable energy, which is mainly like a solar panel.
And what's the water management? I missed that.
So it's Center for Transboundary Water Management. And that's so I was at the Institute for a year. It was in 2012. And then I did an internship with Professor Clive Lipchin for 6 months at the Center for Transboundary Water Management. And what the center tries to do is tries to invest into any collaborative projects between Israelis and Palestinians to overcome the environmental issues that both sides are suffering from and facing. So anything with, you know, like river pollution and, you know, sewage waste and what I did work on, very slightly actually, because I had to leave the institute, was developing a small-scale gray water treatment plant where you take water, like separate the water, black water and gray water, and you treat the gray water and reuse it for irrigation. And we used constructed wetland technology for that. Mm. 2 years ago, I attended their alumni conference twice, and what I'm doing right now here is we're doing this speaking tour to as many campuses, university campuses, and we're having like several public events. And actually, in 2 hours, I'm flying to Colorado, to Denver, and then for San Francisco, then Seattle, Portland, back to Chicago, and Madison, and it's and then back to New York City, and so it's and Boston again. So it's a long tour, and the reason is to, our goal is to raise awareness about the Institute and try to tell people, and especially students, about what the Institute does and if it, you know, interests them in any way. So that's what brought me here.
So in part, you're really trying to also, you're trying to recruit some students from America to participate in these programs.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. It's a very interesting program. One of the things that I really like to talk about this, when I talk about the Institute, is we have a session that is called PILS. It's a Peace Building Leadership Program, or Seminar, yeah. And it's a mandatory program, it's a non-credit program. And it brings all people together, like interns, staff, also, interns and students. And we discuss things, you know, from very, very basic, when we talk about religion, sexuality, spirituality, and all this, and then we dive into, like, the actual core issues of the conflict.
Really?
And we talk about whatever, you know, like Hamas, Holocaust, Nakba, land, resources, checkpoints, and all that type of things. And, you know, you get to learn throughout the process about different skills, such as, you know, compassionate listening, active listening, respect, and how to argue, and... I think it's a great, great program for people to join and learn from it. And of course, there's a lot of fun. There are trips around the region and where you get to actually know about the conflict. And of course, in most cases, in this program, it's a platform that is offered for Palestinians and Israelis to meet each other for the first time ever. And I think this is on a human level. It's on an equal level. And I think that what matters is that when you meet a person, when two nations sometimes dehumanize each other, and then when they meet on an equal level, and there is no this power imbalance between them, I think that's when you can have like a dialogue that may lead to something. 2012, there was this war between Israel and Gaza, and we all went through a lot, you know, and you know, some people that were called up for the military service, and you know, you get all those feelings of like what's going to happen to them, what will they do, how will they hurt anybody, will they hurt, and I remember one time I was threatened, it's not an easy situation, it's challenging in many ways, but at the same time, that's how you grow, right? That's like you when you are triggered and challenged, and that's, you know, how you learn how to overcome all these fears and challenges, and I think this is it was like one of the main turning points in my life.
Really?
Being at the Institute, that's for sure.
Now the Institute is located at Ben Gurion, so that's in Beersheba.
That's the main campus, but the Institute itself is located in Kibbutz Ketura. It's about 40 minutes north of Eilat.
Oh, really?
It's like very down in the Negev area.
Wow.
Yeah.
And as a Palestinian, you must have had to obtain either a permit or a visa to study down there.
Of course,
is that right?
Yeah, I did have a permit to enter there for. So it was my period there was for 3 months, and I got 3 permits. For 3 semesters, and I got 3 permits to go for all the periods.
And I'm assuming that most of the Israeli students that were there with you with the Institute probably had already fulfilled their military service. They had already been in the army. Is that
true? I think yes. Most of them were done with the service. Like, you know, they can be done with everything with the IDF or on reserve.
Did that create any special tension between the Palestinian and Jordanian people and the Israeli people?
This is a question. Interesting. It depends on who you ask and the experiences of, you know, because I heard my stories from my, you know, like whatever, like other Palestinian friends or Jordanian friends or also Israeli friends. But for me, like, this was never a problem because, I mean, okay, so it takes a lot of time actually to. It takes a lot of time to really understand that that's what's happening on the other side, and all what matters is that you listen and understand. You don't have to justify anything, you don't have to deal with anything, you just need to understand. Because the other side also has to understand you. I mean, I don't like to talk about sides and us and them and the, you know what, but like, that's to help the listeners, you know, the people who are listening to us now understand what I'm talking about. But it can definitely create some tension. But I can tell you one thing, that Israelis and Palestinians usually form the strongest friendships and relationships. at the institute. It's very interesting, and it's the people that are living in the region. I mean, other people are going back to South Africa or Brazil or London, you know, like to England, sorry, and then the States. And so it's only the people there that they and who the person that decides to go there knows that there will be, you know, people from the other side, and knows that will be challenging moments. It's very difficult for the Palestinians to see Israelis, you know, celebrating the Independence Day, which is their Nakba Day. But at the same time, you know, like you also look at the Nakba, the Holocaust, and when we, you know, when for instance, we'll go to Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, and, you know, Palestinians won't be, you know, may not all of them, of course I'm making a generalization here, but like not all of them might be aware of the Holocaust and the connection for some Israelis with the Holocaust, and if they have lost any family members there. Sure. And you know, there are a lot of events and a lot of situations where you can actually be very, very challenged and can be very, very challenging. You know, where one word can actually spark a big, big argument, but then, you know, you go back to the dining hall and you all eat together, and, you know, you can sneak into the pool at night, which is not allowed, but, and, you know, things get better again because we're living there, you know. But it's a very, very interesting program, and I think it offers a great perspective at the conflict from an environmental point of view that, yes, we can fight over water, we can fight over money, we can fight over whatever resource it is, but we all are facing that same environmental issues, the same environmental challenges in the region. It's a very small region, so it's like the whole region that people are fighting over is smaller than New Jersey, with all due respect, of course. But so it gives a very valid new perspective to the young generation.
I wonder if you could maybe tell us a little bit about your background, where you were born, where you went to school, what your educational experiences have been.
So I'm 27 years old now, and I was born in Nablus, but we lived in Ramallah, which is kind of like, you know, the most famous city, I think, of the West Bank, with Bethlehem, and I lived there for 11 years, and then me and my family moved to Nablus, because of that's when the second father started, and, you know, the economic situation was very difficult, and so went back to Nablus, where we have like our extended family, and I lived there for another 11 years, and I was 22. That's when I graduated from college. I went to I did civil engineering. That's my background, but I focus on water distribution networks and treatment and stuff like that.
Which college did you attend?
I went to Najah University, which is the biggest university in Palestine, and they have a very good engineering department.
And where is that located?
It's located in Nablus.
Nablus.
Yeah. And after I... So that's interesting. I don't know how much I can talk about this, but between my fourth and fifth year, usually we do like an internship. So I went to Jordan. I did an internship for 2 months, and by like I think the last day... I was with my boss, and he told me, you know what, like he never talked about offering me any opportunities, and he looked at me and he said, you know what, so you finish your studies and you come and work for me. I'm like, this is awesome. Okay, so I go back home, and so as I said, it's a 5-year program, but I could finish in 4 months, 4 years and a half, so I had like about 6 months, and I thought, like, you know what, like that's cool, you know, I can do whatever I want. So after I finished my last semester, a Japanese friend of mine, and his name is Yuki, and if he's listening now, he would laugh so much. He told me about this Arva Institute and this environmental program, and I was like, dude, come on, like, well, I won't go there because I have a job and I can apply for, like, I have an offer. And he said, why don't you just apply? Like, okay, so what we did, like, he literally forced me to write the motivation letter, and I sent it to them, and they scheduled an interview with me, and I was like, well, I know I'm not going there, but I want to have my first interview in English. And I went there, and they're like lovely, lovely people, and they had a great time. And a few days later, I was offered a scholarship, a full scholarship, to go and study there at the Arba Institute. That was 2012. And then I wasn't sure what to do, you know. And there was the whole conflict of should I go for my career or should I go for the Arba Institute, and what people think to, when they, you know, like if they knew that I'm at the Arba Institute, I'm from Israel. So it was like a lot of, you know, internal conflict, I would say, between myself and also me and my close circle of friends and family. But then I decided to go. So I went there for a semester, and you know, it's like the schedule here in the States, it was spring semester, ended in June, and then I went to work in Jordan, and then at some point I was like, no, I really want to do more at the Arabah Institute. I feel that I didn't really get enough of it. Then I quit my job and I go back to the Arabah Institute, and I did another semester as a student. Then I worked there as an intern, and then I was desperate to get funding for my graduate studies because I got admitted to a master's program in the States, but I didn't get any fund. So through the Institute, I did an internship. It's called Keep Chicago Beautiful, where it was me and another alumni of the Institute, and we went there, and that's one of the opportunities that the Institute offers to the alumni. And I go there, and I did the internship, which was amazing. It was about how the city of Chicago deals with the environmental problems. You know, it's not that they're gonna copy and the model of how Chicago functions, but it's about, you know, it gives you a new perspective about several aspects of, you know, the regulations and the environmental education and different types of things regarding the environment in Chicago. And after it ended, I met with many professors throughout the country. Like, I went to Ohio State University, I went to a university in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and even in New York. And then I also got an offer for a PhD. I got admitted for a PhD program, but also without funding. Then I go home and, right before I got home, I was like so desperate, I didn't know what to do. Life is just like, you know, closing its doors. And then I get an email from CometMe, which is, it's Community Energy and Technology. And of course, we'll talk about it. I think that would be your next question. We'll talk about it more in depth, but I get an email from them, and I was like, well, job? Okay, I'll take a job, even though I feel like I was doing graduate studies, but I'll go. So I was going home anyways after a week, and I met with them, and before then, I had already applied for Fulbright. But you know, like any other person who applies for Fulbright, you know that you're not going to get it, and you have no idea who are the people that get Fulbright. So on the same day, like the same exact day, I was nominated for Fulbright and having a great job offer from CometMe. But you know, like, I think there was like one more step for Fulbright until I actually get it and decide to fly. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna take the job and see what happens. And I really, really wanted to stay with Comet. And a few months later, I think that was like 7 months later, I get a placement for Fulbright, and I was going to University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee to do my master's as a Fulbright scholar, which I found to be cool. And it was one of the hardest decisions ever in my life, where I had to decide between CometMe and Fulbright. Of course, people at CometMe were like very, very supportive, incredible. I will never forget the conversation I had with Elad Rian, who's one of the co-founders of the organization, who was of a great support, really. And I thank him for that. And I did my master's and.
In what field was that? What did you study?
So I did policy and economics of freshwater resources at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, which is literally by Lake Michigan, with a great research facilities and labs, and it was really, really cool. And meanwhile, I joined the student chapter of Engineers Without Border. At the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and we all went to Guatemala. I went with 12 Americans, and they were like, "Who's this Palestinian guy that is coming with us?" Because I was in Germany for a few weeks, and then I just like joined them in Guatemala, and it was like kind of awkward, but it didn't really take more than a few minutes to really all get along well and engage in the group. And we went there to install water systems for, like, one water system for Mayan families in the North Highlands of the
Guatemala. These are small scale systems.
Yeah. So usually they have like a spring that is like 2, 3, 4 kilometers, you know, but like 3 miles away. Or 2.5, yeah. And then, we would build like a distribution tank and pipes and, you know, make sure that they have good water at their households. So that's what I did. And then, I got back to the region last summer, and I'm back to work for CometMe again as a part-time. And now I'm here.
Wow, the school. Mm-hmm. So when you get back to Palestine, and you're, is your family still in Nablus? And
yeah.
is that what you consider to be your home now in Nablus? Or, you're kind of a man of the world.
Well, we need to define home and what it means to answer this question. But and people say home is where the heart is, right?
Right.
And I'm not sure where home is now. But my family lives in Nablus now.
And what will you be doing when you get back to Palestine? Do you have a job lined up?
I'm continuing to work with Comet Meme.
Ah, okay.
And it's a great job that they have with a great team and a great organization. And that's what I'm going to be doing.
Well, I know that when I visited Palestine in 2014 and met you, it was actually somebody on the same tour that I was taking who knew about Comet Meme and encouraged a couple of us to go with them to visit that facility, that project. And I was very impressed, and I think that the listeners to the program would probably really enjoy hearing about what Comet Me is doing. It's in the South Hebron Hills, and you're doing work in places that are often in the news, like Susia and Umm El-Khair. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about Comet Me, their history, what they do, how it works, who pays for it.
Well, when you say talk about Comet Me a little bit, that doesn't work for me, but it's definitely like my passion. So Comet Me, so it's a community energy and technology. That's what the name stands for. In 2007, there were two guys, Elad Orian and Noam Dotan, and they are Israelis. Mm-hmm. They're Jewish, and they were very active in the Palestinian struggle.
Really?
And
were they engineers?
if they hear me now, not knowing what they had studied, they'd be mad and be fired. But I know that Elad Orian studied physics, and he has two masters, physics, and he has two masters. And Noam is, as they like to call him, he's Wikipedia. He's like literally a Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. He knows a lot.
A lot.
Yeah, he's literally the smartest person I ever met, and I hope that will be going on air too. So these two guys were doing very, very small projects in Susia to help people there charge their phones and like not more than this. Hmm. And after some years of doing this, they decided why not to have an organization that does work to serve more people. So and that's when Comet Me was founded. So in 2009, I think, or 10, they rented a house in the area, which is like only 5 minutes away from Susia, which is like, again, it's within the communities. Mm-hmm. And they renovated the house, and it became our center. Mm. Okay. So what Comet Me started doing was rural electrification. So a little bit about the communities there. So these communities are in Area C. So the West Bank is divided into three zones, Area A, B, and C. And these zones are defined according to Oslo Accords that, that happened in 1993. And Area A is under the Palestinian Authority, under the Palestinian control for civil and administration affairs. Civil and military affairs, sorry. And the Area C is completely under the Israeli control for civil and military affairs. And but Area C is 65% of the entire West Bank, which is like a huge percentage. Mm-hmm. And that's where the settlements are. So there are like different policies, and I don't like to, I'm not blaming Israel, I'm not blaming Palestine, we're not talking politics now, but one of the things that are happening, and I don't think anyone can argue with it, is that there is a huge movement of settlement expansion and land confiscation from the Palestinian landowners, and the people we work with are all in Area C, and they completely lack any basic services and infrastructure such as roads, water, energy. So you can see the cables of the grid, the Israeli grid, just laid out above them, but they cannot connect. And I know of cases where people just get so desperate, Palestinian people, and they would go and connect with the high voltage line, and they would get completely burned out, like completely. Their bodies are just ash, and so it's tragic there. So that's when Comet Me decided to take part in this and be involved and help people stay in their lands and to support their steadfastness, because after some time, these people would leave because life there is so harsh and so difficult. So what we try to do is we try to, you know, show them that we're there for them and we try to help them and support them. And that's the main concept of what Comet Me does. We provide energy, mainly like using two technologies. We use like wind turbines and we use solar panels. For the wind turbines, we actually build them at our center. So we bring the wood and we curb it and, you know, we polish it and we create the stator, we make the stators and we balance the mount and the tail and for furling and all these technical issues. And we install them, and I think now we have 20 wind turbines that are installed throughout the area there in the south of the West Bank. And also we do solar panels, and we have like the solar panels and also all the electronics, the inverter, the batteries, there are battery systems, battery-based systems, to also provide more energy to the community. So during summertime, usually there's very good sunlight, and in winter there's a very, very good wind, and that, you know, keeps the supply of energy continuous, and there is some security for the people. So and I really like to talk about, like, yes, these communities are very off grid, and you know there are a lot of sustainable development models around the world. But I when I talk about Comet, I really like to talk about reliability, because that's the biggest problem usually between people and people who are underserved and those who come and help them. Is that, and that's from a sustainability point of view, is that when you go to people and you think that you know the answers, but you actually do not really talk to the people and listen to them and see what they need and how we can meet the needs. At our organization, what we do is we approach the people, we understand them, and we build this very important channel of communication and, more importantly, trust. As Comet Me, between Comet Me and the community, and then we work together to help them meet their needs. And I think this model has worked just fine over all the years so far. So one time I remember in 2013, that was before you came to visit us, the region was hit with a very strong snowstorm in 2013, and people, you know, like in Palestine, it's not that we get this very, very often. Yes, now in Boston, it's different. but there, it's not. It's people got really, really prepared for it, and it was a big thing. Everyone was talking about it, and during the storm, some settlements did not have electricity because of the storm. Palestinian cities did not have electricity, and people would drive to our communities where we serve to charge their phones. And that can show you the reliability of the systems that we install and we keep maintained. It's not that we install one system and we leave. No, we continue to be there. And that's why our office is exactly among the communities that we work with. In 2013, we realized that there were two things. One was, and that's when they hired me, there was a big problem with water. So how do people have water there? They have something called cistern, which is a big hole in the ground, and when it rains, you know, the water like just goes into the cistern, which is a big hole, but with all the organic matter and the sheep manure, and the water is just like, oh my goodness, like you cannot even look at it, you know, you cannot smell it. It's really, really bad and turbid, and it's not healthy for sure. And there were many medical reports that we took a look on to understand the problems. So there were like really serious health, public health problem there. And it was caused by the dirty water. So we thought that we should do something about it. We noticed in our energy systems that we usually generate, our system generate energy that is, you know, that meets the needs of the community, but we also have some excess energy. So what to do with this excess energy? So then we came up with a system configuration to provide water services. And I like to make it clear here that Comet Me does not provide water. We only provide water services. What I mean by services is that services such as filtration, storage, distribution, pumping, that type of stuff. So After understanding the problem and understanding the needs, we talked to the people and we did a couple of pilot projects to see how they function and to see the reliability of them. And the system now works as when you have a cistern, we install a pump, a water pump on it, that operates on the excess energy that is generated from the energy system. And this pump pumps water out from the cistern up to the tank that is installed on, that is set up on a mount. And the water has to go through two mechanical filters, 50 and 25 micron. And then after the water is in the tank, it's distributed to different to the convenient places where the user wants them to be at, and usually for troughs, you know, for the animals to drink. But also there is one tab that goes to what they call a kitchen, which could be a little corner in a tent. And at that tab, we install a slow sand filter, and which is the sand has always been used for filtration, like that's from the 1800s. But what we used here is that we learned a lot about different models and different designs, and we work closely with a great, great organization. It's Canadian. It's called CAWST. I think it's Center for Affordable. W is WASH. I forgot, but it's a very unique organization. That publishes several documents and training material to those who are in the field of water and to learn from others' experiences. And we work closely with them. And then we brought some units from them for slow sand filters. And then we developed our own design that can be locally produced and that can be at a much lower cost that people can afford it. And who work closely with a PVC factory in Palestine to actually design these filters and with all the fittings and to deliver to the site at a much, much lower cost than the ones that we brought from Canada. So this filter, I don't know how much I should go into details, but it's basically, it's a lot of sand in one, like if you can think of a 10-inch tube, and it's filled with sand, then when you put water in it, at the top 5 to 6 centimeters of that sand, there will grow a microbiology layer that feeds off the new organisms that enter the filter next time you pour in water. And it takes, of course, some time for this layer to develop and to grow, but that's how it works. Now, if you talk about efficiency, so my office was in a cave, was like one small tiny table in a cave, okay? And I would go down the cave, and I would sit on my table, and I would do water testing, water quality testing. So the source for us is the cistern. So when I test the water from the cistern, I get a sample, like, you know, like you get the water and like you add the media for the bacteria to grow, and then you count how many colonies, which means how many bacteria colonies have grown on the petri dish.
Yeah.
Then if you count up to 100, you stop counting because it's meaningless. It's just like, yeah, it's more than enough. It's enough. So when we count when we do this test on the water from the system, we get plus 100, like more than 100 colonies. Yeah. If you test it after the slow sand filter, you wanna guess?
0 to 1.
Of course, in some cases, you know, sometimes you get like 2 and you get 10, and if there is like any, you know, sometimes you may get like more than this. It depends on the water and the event and the season, and you know, if something happened to the filter, if something happened to the source. But 0 to 1, and this meets the standards of the WHO, the World Health Organization.
Where was that technology developed? Was that developed in the region, or was it developed? Was that from Canada?
No. I think it's everywhere. Again, sand was has always been used.
Not new, so it's old technology.
It's a very old technology, but you need to modify it and make it work for the people that are using it.
Got
you know. And for instance, like the process of dealing with the sand is enormous. Like sieving the sand, because you need some, like a certain size of the particles. You don't need it to be very, very big because water will just like sieve through and won't be filtered. And also, if it's like too small, it will clog. So, and then you need to wash the sand because you don't want to have minerals and salts in the sand, because it's sea sand that we have in Palestine. So again, there are like different, there are a lot of, it's a very, very long process for this.
Does the sand have to be continuously replaced? Is that...
That's a great question. And I went, when I went back from the States to see Coma, and then I asked if they have ever replaced any filter, and they said no.
My gosh.
So I'm talking about at least 2 years. 2 years. I know at some point you need to replace, you know, but it's definitely more than 2 years, because until now the filters have been working just fine.
That's an extremely sustainable system then. Extremely sustainable.
Well, I cannot judge my our design, but I think so. I think you know, of course, we have annual reports on the website, which is www.comet-me.org, and we also have data loggers for our energy systems, where we can, you know, you can go there and check the site and the village or the community that we work in. We get all the data of that.
So I wanted to ask you a bit about the business model and how this system, how Comet.me finances these systems. Do they charge? Where is the investment money coming from? How do people pay for the electricity that they're consuming or is needed to run the water systems? Can you give us a sense as to how that works?
Of course. So here... finances is like two separate issues here. We have one with the community itself and with the people who are our beneficiaries, and also the donors that we get our money from. So for the donors, we mainly rely on, we get most of our funding from Europe. It could be the EU, and of course there's a list of all donors that we have on the website. Okay. Again, www.comet-me.org. So we have, the EU, the Irish, the Dutch. So we get funding from several places in Europe, and also some, donations from American individuals that give money to the organization, which I think is very, very important to us, because that's what keeps us going and that's what keeps us doing what we're doing, to help people stay in their lands and give them the services that everyone else need. You know, like I remember the first time I worked for Comet, and the first day I went back to my apartment in Hebron, which is 45 minutes away from where we work, and I opened the tap to get a glass of water, and then I'm like really, really struck by that. I never thought that some people do not have this tap, and they do not have water, clean water that you can drink right away. Okay. It's crazy. It's insane. And I learned a lot from this experience to really appreciate very, very small things in life that we definitely take for granted. So that answers the question about the donors and where we get our money from.
Yeah, and what about the people who are actually using the right. energy generated? Do they pay for the
right.
energy?
Right, that's a great question for our business model, for how we function. So basically, they pay exactly as much as I pay, or people in cities pay for the electricity utility. So what happens is, you know, if you give people something that they do not put any effort to get, and it's like a gift, they won't really, really take care of it. And we notice that, and people themselves know that when they pay for it, they can take care of it, of the system. So if you're not paying for the electricity and you turn the light on all day long, it's consuming energy from their system, from their batteries. So when Comet staff goes home, they'll be the only ones left out with the system. So if you keep it, you keep it for yourself. Because I'm not going to come to you when it's 3 in the morning if it's not like really emergency. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So what people do is that we have them pay for their electricity. It's a little amount, for sure, because they don't consume much. Well, let me start with one thing that we do is that they have a daily limit for the electricity that they can use. Of course, this daily limit is adequate for their needs on a daily basis. So what are the needs? The needs is that they need lighting, refrigerator, a word that I always fail to pronounce properly. It's a butter chunk. It's like the one for the milk.
Oh, a butter churn.
Butter churn. Okay. I will never try to say
yes,
this.
Right.
You can keep
butter
it.
Churn.
And both butter churn.
And that's necessary because many of these people have sheep and goats.
Absolutely.
And milk those animals.
Absolutely. And it saves them a lot of time to do it manually, you know, otherwise. So You're actually giving them, you know, like it's a great thing to have for them to have electricity, because then they don't have to do it manually and spend, I don't know, like triple the time doing it.
Sure.
But they can't, for instance, have air conditioning. Absolutely not. But still, you know, it's not what they need. Also, it's not that they don't look for this. Like much, it's much simpler than this for them, you know. And also, they want people to really support them more than just, you know, give them luxury and, you know, that lifestyle of what maybe you have here in the States or some people may have in, you know, other parts of the world. So those are their demands. So when
you've also told us that, you told us earlier that there's enough power to charge cell phones, for example.
Oh, absolutely.
And what about televisions and computers?
Definitely.
There is. Okay,
yes,
good.
Yes. I should have mentioned that. But yeah, TVs, radios, cell phones, laptops, of course, as I said, refrigerators, and the thing that I'm not going to try to pronounce again,
butter churn.
And again, they pay for it. So how do they pay for it? So we have meters that they can be charged when you insert a certain number, like a serial number, mm-hmm. that we give them from Comet. Okay, so they would call us and say, well, can you please charge our meter with 100 shekels, for instance, which is about like $25. And this can last up to maybe like 2 or 3 months or something.
Is that right?
Yeah. And some people can live with, like, longer with this amount of money, with this amount of electricity that they're paying for. And we take the money and we give them a receipt. But do we take it for company? The answer is no. So what do? We take this money and we give it to a trustee, give it to a lawyer, that opens a bank account under the name of the community. And this money is deposited under the name of the community. And no one can withdraw this money without having the community representative, a person from CometMe, and the lawyer or the trustee. Okay? So it's a triangle. And they have all to be there on the same page when they want to deal or do something with the money. So why do we get this money? Well, as I said, first, it's important for the people to know that they're paying for their electricity, so they can keep it and they take care of the system, and they do not consume just for the sake of consuming. No, they actually know what they're doing. You know, so it gives them a sense of ownership for the system, and a sense of responsibility and management of the system. That's number one. Number two, this money can be used for maintenance. Of course, like if you have a household and you have a son that got married and wants to, you know, have his own or her own household, we go as Comet and we connect them. We do the AC installation. We provide, you know, whatever we could at no expense, at, you know, zero expense, and we just like help them to get that. But for instance, if you talk about big components that can be very costly, and for instance, the batteries usually last between, I think it's around 8 years, and then they need to be replaced. That's the life cycle for the batteries. So I remember in one of the communities, I don't want to mention the name, they have been paying for 6 years now, and we wanted to change their batteries. Mm-hmm. All they could save was 14,000 shekels, which is about, I would say, $3,000. Mm-hmm. But the total price for the new set of batteries for the community was 240,000.
Oh my gosh.
So it's about 200 times. No, 200 or 20. No, 200.
Right.
No, 20.
Yeah, 20.
20. Well, so it's, we're talking about I don't know, like 80,000. I think it's about 80,000, yeah, or $75,000, and they only collected about 3,000 or like 5,200. You know, then we raised fund for this maintenance, for the replacement of the batteries. So,
is that from the same funding sources that we talked about?
Yeah, we have like different...
Europe, the EU, American...
So, yes, we try to help them understand that this money is your money, and we collect this money for you. And they understand this, and they do it. And it's not they come to you and say, well, I don't want to pay. You know, of course, no one wants to pay. Like, I want everything to be for free for me, right? I want you to come and give me a car right now for this interview, maybe. But it's not how it works sometimes, you know, because it's a gift. It's not that I'm going to take care of it. And this is a very important...
So I wanted to just ask again, each family actually has its own separate account and contributes money. It's not done communally. The money that that they deposit into the Comet Me account is for their family,
right,
only their family. And you had mentioned earlier, just very briefly, that there is a limit on how much energy each family is able to obtain every day.
Mm-hmm.
And how much is, what is that limit and how is it established?
It's 2.5 kilowatt per day.
Wow.
Kilowatt hour per day. I'm not sure about the unit, but
wow,
it's about, yeah. And that we know that it's enough because we monitor all our systems online. And if it's not online, you know, we go there and we get the, there's a memory card that
mm-hmm.
we have there that, you know, blocks all the data, and we just take it, plug it in our laptops, and we look at the data and see if there's a problem, if there's like an overconsumption, you know, what, you know, how many days they run out of energy, and we find, no, okay, well, if yes, then maybe we need to do an upgrade. There's a problem here or there. We talk to the community, they come to us, they know us. So when we have a day limit, it's not that we are controlling them or preventing them from using energy, but it's more of keeping the system and keeping the battery in a good shape. One thing I did not talk about, that's for the energy that we collect money.
Yeah.
For the water system, they pay a small portion. It's about $100, which is not bad at all
mm-hmm.
for these communities. And this is a fixed amount that they pay.
Just one time?
That's one time per connection. And they get it. Of course, the total cost of the system is much higher than this.
Sure.
They pay less than 10% of the total cost.
Mm.
So, yeah.
And what is the source of the water? We didn't really... Is it basically rainwater that's going into the cisterns?
It is rainwater. And I'll answer this after a second. But
yeah,
for the payment, so now you have a water pump, right? And the pump operates using electricity.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. So who pays for this? So what we do is, we have... I really can't go into the technicalities here because I'm not sure that I fully comprehend how it works, but there is... divert excess energy from the energy system and take electricity to operate the pump.
Okay.
So no one is paying for the pump.
Sure.
So the community or the people or the household does not actually pay for the pump. And the pump continues to operate and pumps water up the tank, and then we have an overflow that takes water back to the system. About your question, yes, they mainly depend on rainwater. But now when they run out of water in the cistern, if they have like a small tiny cistern, then they have to go and purchase
water.
Yeah.
And bring it in tanks.
Right. And that's why I said earlier at the beginning of the interview when we started talking about Comet Me is that we do not provide water, we provide water services.
Right. So I want to just switch gears slightly, and that is to ask you about conditions in the South Hebron Hills. I know that I just visited Susia just a few weeks ago. I've been there several times. And Susia, like some other communities in the South Hebron Hills, are under demolition orders. And it's been my understanding that perhaps even some of the Comet Me systems are at risk. Is that your understanding as well, or are they protected?
Right. Now we're talking politics.
Yeah, well,
most of our systems are under the threat of demolition, and we got demolition orders from the Israeli Civil Administration, which is the Israeli body that is responsible for LEC that I talked about earlier in the West Bank in Palestine. So this is a very big challenge for us to work there, and we're hoping to expand in other places, in other parts of the West Bank, and some places are actually very, very, very hot zones, and will be a big challenge for us to actually go there and do some work. However, we provide some legal assistance to the communities that receive these demolition orders regarding our systems, and we try to provide them with, I actually do this type of work right now as an outreach coordinator, and also doing some planning, I go to the community and make sure that they have all the papers, and I collect them from the community, and we try to reach to get a hold of like our lawyers in Israel and proceed with the legal case and see how we can help the community. So yeah, it's a big thing that we're facing on a daily basis. Just right before I came to the States, I was working in a very tense case for solar panels. Our solar panels in a community of the one of the communities that we're serving, and they got a demolition order, and we just like so rushed to actually submit a permit application to you know, to the Israeli side to, you know, try not to have it
Have any, of your systems ever been demolished?
No.
You have never lost
yet.
A system
yeah,
yet?
Yeah, and not yet.
And you attribute Hopefully. That to the strength of the lawyers? The lawyers are...
I think there are a lot of players in the field when it comes to this. And I'm not sure how much I can talk about this, but definitely we get the support of the lawyers and the donors and Comet, and it's a collective effort for sure.
Sure.
And we try to really resist against this very harsh reality that the people there are facing.
Now, I just learned actually within the past several weeks that Comet has installed a rather large series of panels in the Bethlehem area, or in Bethlehem. And that sounds like going beyond rural electrification. So is there a diversification now going on at Comet?
That's a great question. So you're talking about happened a few weeks ago, right? Like a couple months ago?
Apparently, yeah.
It's the inauguration is happening very soon, by the way. It's a place called, it's a village called Jibidib. And they don't have electricity because it's an area C, and we managed to provide them with energy.
Like over, I think I heard the number over 70 panels, which is a pretty good size.
I think it's over 90.
Over 90 panels.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a pretty good size system.
Right.
How large a community is that in terms of
the problem is that they were working with the system while I was still in the States, so I'm not sure about how much I know about the community, but it's a powerful story. So what happened there is that men always try to reach out to different organizations to get energy services, and they never managed to. They would go to the governorate and go to different places, but they did not really succeed. So the community, the women of the community came all together, and they formed a women council or a women committee, and this one could actually manage to get different players together. And CometMe was worked very closely with the governorate of Bethlehem, and also with the representative, the head of the representative office of the Netherlands for the PA, and we all worked together to provide this system, which, and people are very, very happy about them. And I just met the guys there, that people from the community, just couple 3 weeks ago or something, beginning of January, and they seem to be very, very thrilled to have this. Now they have TVs, and I heard stories about, you know, how, like, one woman told us about how her daughter once needed to do some research on the internet, and she had to wait until her dad came back from work at 8 p.m. to take her to a nearby village where they had internet to do the research. And now the daughter can just do research anytime she wants, because now she has internet and she has a laptop and she can do all she wants to do for school. And you have no idea how much, like, this system, this very basic thing that we take for granted, which is electricity, can change people's lives and can educate people and can, you know, let them go to school and do other activities and save the mother's time to do other things, you know. They can have, like, you know, their own businesses. They can have time to take care of the household, or time to, you know, look for jobs and different types of things. So it's much more than just giving them the ability to switch this button on and get light.
It sounds like feminist power is alive and well in Palestine.
Yes, it's rolling. It's rolling. Yeah. So that's the community that that's our last success. And it was a different type of technology that we used. It's again solar panels, but also it was a little bit different than the work we used to do in the South Mount Hebron area. And we were definitely so proud of it.
You have been listening to Stephen Lowe interviewing Mohammed El-Khiraz, engineer and environmentalist working to bring water and sustainable energy to isolated communities in the West Bank. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.